I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City's homicide rate is the highest it's been in 8 years. For Gene Peters Baker, that's a big deal. Today we speak with Jackson County's prosecutor to find out how she's helping reduce violent crime and to see if blight is part of the problem. We'll also get her thoughts on the mayor's task force on violence, which has a report due out today. Then a look at income disparity and why the top 1% earns more than the bottom 50. We'll find out how an economist and MacArthur fellow looks at the wage gap and why he thinks more skilled workers could narrow it. Later, Brian McTavish and the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker took a break from the law for a couple of hours yesterday to host a neighborhood cleanup event at 23rd Street and Denver Avenue in Kansas City. She's also been grappling with Kansas City's homicide count, which tops last year's, and just finished work with a national committee of big city prosecutors that released a report with recommendations for how she and their colleagues should handle police shootings. All this comes on the day that a Citizens Task Force in Kansas City releases its report on how to address the city's violent crime problems. Gene Peters Baker, welcome back. So good to have you.
Good morning. Good to be back.
You spent part of yesterday raking yards and picking up trash on the city's east side. Why would the Jackson County prosecutor take some time off to do something like that?
Because blight equals crime. That's a direct link. Blight equals crime. So if we can put some time and attention on cleaning up blight, I think we will see to a level an abatement of crime. So that was our objective. We have adopted this particular block as well at 23rd and Denver as a block that we wanted to give some special time and attention to.
And that job, that block, because why?
Well, because partially because it is part of East Zone, where we received a federal grant to do some special projects in that area, but also because it was a block that we studied, and we knew it needs our time and attention. We went out there at night. We went out during the day. We went out after school so I could kind of see traffic patterns. I saw a lot of kids with backpacks walking home from school. And I thought, this is a block that has numerous habitable residents where kids live, but it also has several vacant homes, which draw problems.
So were you raking or painting, or what's your preferred job? What's the Jackson County prosecutor want to do on a day like that?
Well, look, I pulled some brush. I got to, you know, maybe I'm feeling a little stiff this morning because I'm not used to that kind of labor. It was good for me, though.
This federal grant that you mentioned, which is helping fight violent crime on the east side, what is that grant enabling you to do exactly?
It allows us to put a focus on community prosecution. So what I've been able to do is put a community prosecutor in that station.
What's a community prosecutor?
Community prosecutor is something that puts a special focus on a particular geographic area. So in this case, it will be East Zone, and our objective, not surprisingly, is to reduce violence, gun violence. In particular,
how can a prosecutor help reduce gun violence?
Well, there are many, many ways. And the first, though, is that we find ourselves present, that we are at neighborhood meetings, that we know neighborhoods, we know people who live on certain blocks, and police officers know us. And so they know who to communicate with. We are at the ground level, at crime level, right? We're not waiting for a file to come packaged, delivered to our office at 1415 Locust. We are at the street level.
And when people feel comfortable with you, that can change the dynamic there a lot, right?
It can, absolutely. So what I also thought was important yesterday was to knock on all the doors around the block that we have adopted to say, hey, we're not here to descend on your neighborhood in some negative way. We're here to assist you, sort of lift you up, and also help these vacant homeowners, if we can find them, and say, we want to work with you. We want to turn this abandoned structure into something that is good for this block.
So you have absentee landlords engaged here, which can be a problem tracking down. Gene, do I have that right?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That is a problem.
Yeah.
But in particular, anybody who may be listening, if you own a property on that strip of 23rd and Denver, we want to talk to you. We want to sit down with you, and we want to help sort of devise a plan that will enable this block to be a stronger block.
What would you like to see happen with the absentee landlords? Do you want more local ownership to take place, or what's the objective?
There's no doubt we want more local owners. Mm. But the primary objective is that those homes become habitable, that families live in those homes, that they're not standing vacant. One house, we believe, is two pit bulls reside in the home, right? Mm. We watch them come out on the roof on occasion.
On
right?
the roof.
On the roof. So, you know, that's not the kind of ownership that we're looking for. We're looking for families to move into that neighborhood that will keep the lawns trimmed, that will keep the trash out, and will report crime when they see it.
Yeah. Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker is my guest. You know, we're having this conversation, Gene, on the same day that Mayor Sly James' Citizen Task Force on Violent Crime is releasing its report. In fact, it just came out after a year's worth of study. We've had these reports come along before, and they don't seem to make a whole lot of difference. What's your hope for this one?
You know, my hope for this one is that it stems, it's the beginning of something. They have several recommendations that I think are good ones, but we have had a mayor that has been very, very engaged in this process and in this effort. He's been a huge partner to my office. And, you know, by the way, we have this whole task force because of his urging and his setting it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we already have a lot of momentum with Mayor James behind this task force, but also it was led by Jolie Justice, who's
the councilwoman. Yeah,
Councilwoman Justice. She's impressive, and I think the whole task force took this very seriously and tried to find real solutions to these very real problems.
I want to stay with this, but we have a call here from David from Prairie Village, who has a question about a home has adopted a block on Brooklyn Avenue, and he has a question about that. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I think it's great that the county is taking interest in this issue. From my own experience, you know, to me, I'm wondering if it's good for the county's time that they would improve the tax foreclosure process, because there's a lot of the homes over on the east side that have tax foreclosure issues, title issues, once you go through that tax foreclosure process. So one way that I've practically found from my experience would be to, is there a way to cure the blight by having the county and the appropriate officials systematically look at what's contributing to the blight problem, in particular the tax foreclosure, cleaning up of the titles issue?
I'm not sure I'm tracking that phrase he's using. You mean, David, they owe money, they owe back taxes?
Yeah, so what happens is a lot of the homes, they don't pay their county taxes. It goes to tax foreclosure, and immediately you have title problems with those homes. And that contributes to blight because you can't get in there and rehab the homes without clearing that title. So I was just curious if the prosecutor could speak to that issue and what her thoughts would be around that.
Is that a concern, Gene?
Well, I think tax foreclosure is probably not quite as common as the overall problem that I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Homes that are simply not habited, right? That they stand vacant for years. And that draws a lot of other ills to a mm-hmm. neighborhood when a home or a series of homes on a block stands vacant. In regard to the caller's question about tax foreclosure, I will say I do think the county does a pretty good job of trying to work with people, but they have to kind of come to the table and devise a plan of how they can pay back what they owe.
What's the issue typically? Is it difficult to find the absentee landowner? Is there an unwillingness to sell the home or pay the back taxes? Or where does the rubber hit the road here?
Most of the time, in my experience, it's been the absentee landowner, and it's very difficult to kind of figure out who that is and what is their level of interest in that particular home. Do they want to come to the table and be a problem solver with us? That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for people who may be willing to come to that table, come to my table, and let's work together.
Yeah, I was struck going back to the mayor's Citizens Task Force on Violent Crime, that the report that just came out. There's no recommendation in that report, just from glancing through it quickly before going on the air, for dealing with the proliferation of handguns in Kansas City. Mayor James has been so outspoken on that issue, lobbying the General Assembly for stricter gun control laws up here. But this task force takes a pass on the gun issue. What do you make of that?
I make of that the reality. That's where we are. The Missouri legislature
isn't going to budge on it. Yeah,
and they've been very clear about that. They have control over the issue, and they have even in January of this year, a new gun law or lack of a gun law went into play that really impacts my office in a very strong way, because I lost a felony provision that allowed me to be very proactive on individuals who did not go through the proper licensing for CCW.
This is concealed carry.
Carry. And so I think, you know, really the task force was probably just trying to say, what can we actually do? I've worn a path to the legislature myself, asking them to consider Kansas City, the impacts, perhaps the unintended consequences, perhaps that may come about from some of the changes in gun laws that they wanted to impact on Missouri. But here we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so where I stand today is trying to encourage people to be responsible gun owners. I think I still have a voice to do that. And that that means securing your weapons when they're not in use, making sure that children cannot get access to your gun.
Because we see that tragically so often in our town.
Absolutely. Every year. Mm-hmm. Every year. And that is so preventable. Mm-hmm. You know, you can absolutely prevent a child from getting a hold of your weapon and causing harm to themselves or others.
Yeah.
So gun responsibility is at the top of my list now.
You know, for a few years now, we've had this KC Nova effort in Kansas City. That's the Kansas City No Violence Alliance. The idea was to provide, you know, a more comprehensive approach to fighting violent crime by providing this array of social services and by combining the efforts of federal and state and local authorities all together here. And yet, in recent years, homicides and aggravated assaults in Kansas City are up and going up. What's your sense of what's going on and the effectiveness of KC Nova here?
You know, that's a great question, and it's one that I have grappled with pretty steadily over the past 2 years. I think there's
the theory is so strong.
The theory is a strong one, and there's academic findings behind it, and there are other cities like Kansas City as well who have reaped some of the benefits of this idea called focused deterrence. It is a proactive measure to address violence before it occurs. And so if you're looking at strict numbers and comparing them, you know, from 2014 onward, you're going to say, well, this clearly doesn't work. Although in 2014, we did largely credit the reduction in homicides due to the No Violence Alliance.
The numbers dipped that year dramatically, yeah.
One of the things that also happened in 2014 was, you know, the knowledge of a town in Missouri called Ferguson. And I think we all, major cities around the country, are really experiencing some of the impacts of Ferguson. We all maybe have a little different take on how that directly impacted us, but there's no doubt there has been an impact since Ferguson.
Does something need to be tweaked with KC Nova? Is it working the way you think it should be working, or is there just so much violence out there that even an effort like this can't get to it?
There is a lot that can be tweaked about KC Nova, and they are in the process of working on that daily. They, me, as well as the mayor, the police chief, a variety of us come to the table.
What's one thing you would tweak about it that is that maybe I could relate to a little bit?
One of the things that we are working on, I'll give you two. One of the things that we're working on is a partnership with the Kansas City, Missouri School District so that we can work with kids that we know are in, that are on a path, or that have high risk or high needs. And so we want to put them in an after-school program where we are working very proactively with them. We want to keep them on a good path.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important that we don't wait, but that we are reaching out to youth in advance of trouble.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty critical. And KC Nova is in the middle right now of forming that partnership and rolling out that after school program.
Yeah. Are you discouraged by this recent spike in crime? I mean, we're trying to do things differently in this town, and it seemed to work in 2014, but the story since then has been one bump after another when it comes to homicides and aggravated assault.
Am I disappointed? Well,
discouraged,
you know,
yeah.
Discouraged. I live through every single text that comes to me, email, phone call, about the latest shooting that occurred, the latest murder that occurred, the latest body found. So, of course, that is discouraging. But one can't sit in discouragement, right? There's a lot of promise and there's a lot of hope. And there's also a lot of obligation on the part of those of us in law enforcement to get it right and to keep mm-hmm. sort of honing our efforts so that we get it right. We are in the middle of a increase in violence that is seen around the country. We sometimes overstate it. I will say that we overstate and sort of, the violence that we are experiencing relative to trends across the country. However, it is up, and we all acknowledge that. You can't deny numbers, but there is the bottom line remains true. Violence is preventable. It is preventable, 100% mm-hmm. preventable. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot with that statement. There's only up to go from, right?
Yeah.
There's only positive things that we can do to impact that bottom line. Will we be successful? Not always. But we must keep trying. And we must keep honing our efforts.
Now, I've always wondered about folks like you, Gene. You've had a long stint in the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office. You've handled any number of different jobs there. You came in under Claire McCaskill when she was the Jackson County Prosecutor. And I'm wondering, how do you combat this idea of developing a jilted view of humanity when you deal with violence on a daily basis, as you do, week in and week out?
Well, that is the part that disappoints me, I suppose. If there's a disappointment or a discouragement, it is that some of us in our metro region have a prevailing view that there's nothing we can do about this, that mm-hmm. we should sort of throw in the towel.
It's part of life here in the big city.
Part of life in the big city. I disagree wholeheartedly and firmly mm-hmm. in that statement. And maybe it's because I actually see the people that are impacted by violence. Sometimes, you know, that's beyond the people that are just hit by the bullets. It's the block. It's people who live on a block where a crime occurred and you see the impact on them.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are worth saving and those people are worth our time and attention. And we must do a better job in focusing on the greater impact of violence on our city. And that is victims and witnesses of crime deserve to be lifted up, protected, supported, and championed.
Yeah.
Championed when they contact police and they work with police to solve a crime. They are not snitches. Those folks are heroes in my mind.
Now, what do you say to people who suggest that the way to deal with crime is you've got to go so much farther than we are in Kansas City or anywhere for that matter, that we've got to tackle poverty systemically. We've got to tackle, education, the education piece, and then providing jobs to everyone who wants one. You do those things, massive programs, and then you finally get to the crime issue. And in the meantime, we're really not going to get there. And the stats would suggest that we really won't.
Well, and you missed economic development. That's
economic
another
development.
Piece that must
Thank
be
you.
Done as well.
Yeah.
All of those things are true. Absolutely. All of those things are true. But there is much that we can do, even though perhaps we can't radically change any one of those, problems that
yeah.
you leveled. I think there improvement must start from where we are. A street at 23rd in Denver that has a lot of blight, it has a lot of trash, a lot of brush that's built up. Well, let's just start there, right? Let's start there by cutting back the brush, picking up the tires, and letting those families know that live on that block, we care about you.
Were they happy you were there?
They were happy we were
yeah.
that we were there. At first, they were a little suspicious
I
about
bet.
What we might be doing there. But I made sure that we knocked on every door, delivered a letter and a T-shirt letting them know, hey, we are here to help you. We are not here to come in and harm
throw you.
You
in jail. Yeah.
We are here to help.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Vince from Waldo. Vince, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Thanks good, Vince.
Thanks for having the subject. All right. I was a volunteer with KC Nova the last three summers.
Oh, good.
And I want to say, first of all, there's not just one answer to stopping violence. And this is a great answer because what you're doing is creating dialogue between those people who are actually in the community, and you're creating that great conversation that needs to take place so they can tell you exactly what they need. And I'm glad you did address that. Yeah, you got economics that are not being addressed. You've got, racism that is always overlooked in a lot of these cases. And with that, my thing is, please champion KC Nova because it's that link that you've always never had, and now it's here. So champion it so that it can. What's going to happen if you keep KC Nova going? You're going to fatten that line of dialogue between people who have the resources with people who don't. And so also, too, my second comment along with that, it throws me back to, I want to say, probably the early 80s here in Kansas City. They had a program called NYSP, National Youth Sports Program. Great program. They used to have it at all the schools. Basically, it was probably from the hours of 10 to 6. Any kid could come. You come and basically do sports activities all day long. They would feed you. Great program, but for some reason, it went astray. And I say that's where your problem is. Everybody wants to come down on programs that are not making a big dent in violence. They're not understanding. This problem hasn't been addressed in years, decades, centuries.
Vince, I'm going to scoop because I want to get to KCUR's Peggy Lowe, who is one of our reporters. She went to the mayor's news conference this morning, the task force news conference. She joins us now from the parking lot of St. Mark Child and Development Center, where the press conference was held today. And Peggy, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. And the press conference is still going on. Mayor Sly James is still talking as we speak.
And I just want to point out, and I appreciate you stepping out to visit with us for a moment, that Vince's comment about this after-school program, these kinds of programs, I think the task force addressed just what he was talking about.
Absolutely. And Councilwoman Jolie Justice, who chaired the Citizens Task Force on Violence, and obviously they're giving their final recommendations today, she said, and her big takeaway is that Kansas City has all the tools they need for this community-based effort to combat violence. And she said, now we just have to get out into the community and leverage these tools, and that people need to start talking to each other about all these different programs, whether it's NOVA or the other one your caller just mentioned. And they have, one of the recommendations is actually a full-time staffer in the mayor's office who would be coordinating all that and acting as kind of the umbrella so that everyone can become under this and start working together.
Peggy, are there one or two other recommendations that you would point to that maybe stood out to you a little bit?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I thought it was really interesting that they've called for the city to work with the congressional delegation to secure a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study of the recent increase in homicides in Kansas City. That is, part of the overall plan to really look at this violence as a public health issue. Jolie also said, we have worked on smoking and drinking and drunk driving as a public health issue. Let's do it with violence. So I thought that was pretty interesting. They're calling for a youth master plan to really, get down and coordinate the services that support kids. And as I mentioned, too, I think the full-time staff position is interesting. And Mayor Sly James said they have already budgeted for that job. So he is putting his money where their mouth is.
All right. Well, that's KCUR's Peggy Lowe reporting about this morning's news conference, the release of the Citizens Task Force on Violent Crime in Kansas City. Peggy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Gene Peters-Baker, before you scoot here, I just wanted to bring up this notion that Kansas City is looking for a new police chief these days as Daryl Forte just announced his retirement. I'm wondering what recommendations you would make for that job. And, is it time for an outsider to step in, or do you have a sense of who you'd like to see in there?
I don't have a sense of the who, but I have a sense of what the qualities should look like. And the quality of that person, it could be internal or external. It must be someone, though, must be someone who looks at neighborhood as a partnership, looks at neighborhood as someone that they are supposed to guard and protect, doesn't go to war with neighborhood. So that's essential to me. Must be. It's a must.
That's Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker visiting with us this morning. And Gene, it's always good to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. Coming up, we're going to take a break. Then we're going to look at income disparity across the country and what to do about it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we visited with two members of Congress, Kevin Yoder and Emmanuel Cleaver. You can find our conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. It's also on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll explore the art of discovery and adventure and get a primer on what you can find at this weekend's KC Poetry Throwdown. That's tomorrow on the show. Well, we all know that the gap in this country between the haves and have-nots have swelled to its widest point in nearly 100 years. In fact, one recent study found that the top 1% of all wage earners earns 81 times more than the bottom 50%. Now, a conversation about our changing economy and in the relative demand for high and low-skilled workers and our nation's ability to supply the skills that are most needed today. With us is Kevin Murphy. He's an economist who teaches economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's the first business school professor ever to be named a MacArthur Fellow. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Welcome. So good to have you, Kevin.
Oh, great. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Just how dramatic is the income gap these days?
I think it's both dramatic but also pervasive. And those are the two things that don't always get mentioned. And
meaning, and the distinction you're drawing there is what?
You know, like we are leading, we talked about the gap between the top 1% and the rest of the population. But actually, if you look at the data about what's happened, is the growth in inequality is much more pervasive. You would find if you compared the middle of the distribution to the bottom, that gap's expanded enormously.
Huh.
Or the gap between the 75th percentile and the 50th percentile.
So everything is expanding out.
In fact, if you look over the 40-plus year period over which this has happened, that's the other big thing. This is not a new event. We've had rising inequality in the United States for over 40 years. And if you look over that whole period, it's as if you just stretched everything out. Every gap between the different parts of the distribution have grown.
And the consequence of that is what?
Consequence of that is that I don't want to say consequence as much as what is it telling us about mm-hmm. what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is we're not meeting the needs of our population in terms of providing them the skills they need to keep up. And when you don't get the skills to keep up with the changing marketplace, you fall behind.
So to you, the solution here, the remedy, maybe being too simplistic as we do here in the media, is addressing this skills gap that you just mentioned.
I think that's imperative. And it's imperative not just for addressing inequality, but more so for improving the standard of living of all the broad set of Americans. I just don't see how we can do that without it.
And by a skills gap, you're talking about talents and skills like what, Kevin?
I would say it runs the gamut from education. We've fallen way short in the sense to which we've improved the education of our population. That started around 1980. We started about 1980 to fall behind what the economy was demanding.
Kids need high school degrees. More kids need to be going to college.
I would say on both dimensions, more years and years that are better tuned to what the market demands. So mm-hmm. it's both about getting more people to go from high school to college, more people to finish college, not just start, but also within college graduates, produce college graduates that have the mix of skills that are demanded today.
Skills like what?
Oh, the ability to use technology and contribute to technology, not be displaced by technology, but to actually work with technology.
Mm-hmm.
Same is true among high school graduates. We need more high school graduates who have marketable skills, identifiable things that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to employers, what do they tell you? I mean, I'm sure you've talked to employers. They say, man, if I could get more people who could run a machine tool effectively, I need them. I can't mm-hmm. find them.
Mm-hmm.
Or college graduate populations. I need people who know how to work with data or people who know how to take this to the next level in terms of marketing our products.
Yeah. You know, going back to the income gap, you know, what's caused this? Because I think you have written or have talked about over the years just the fact that it might be as simple as this technology gap. People don't know how to work with technology in this country to the extent that we need to. And it's technology that's to blame for all of this. You buy that?
I don't want to say it's to blame, but technology is a big part of the story.
Yeah.
But it's not new. One of the things I've done is study a longer period of time. If you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, so you'll go back to 1900, think about what the economy looked like then. That was pre-electrification. There were really no cars, no airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
The modern industry, the way we knew it, didn't really exist. Computers weren't even thought of. A large number of Americans made their living essentially as beasts of burden. They provided physical energy,
mm-hmm.
and that was the first jobs to go.
Mm-hmm.
We later replaced jobs of very, basically simple tasks that machines could do. Gradually, machines got to be able to do more and more complicated tasks, like assemble cars. And so that process has been going on for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a race between technology moving forward and us pushing our workforce forward. And when the workforce falls behind, what happens? There's too much demand for high-skilled workers, not enough supply.
Mm-hmm.
Too much supply of low-skilled workers, not enough demand. And we all know what happens when there's lots of demand and not much supply. Prices go up.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know what happens in the other case. Lots of supply, not much demand, prices go down.
So that's been a big factor in this income gap then, this technology gap that we're talking about here.
And the supply side,
mm-hmm.
not meeting what the market demands.
Mm-hmm.
Because for roughly the 80 years of the 20th century, we had progressing technology, but we replaced a lot of low-skilled workers with a lot more high-skilled workers and were able to keep the income gap in check.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start falling behind, then demand runs ahead of supply, and we all know what happens when you got more demand and less supply. Prices rise.
Are you seeing efforts by governors and presidents of this country to address this skills gap adequately, Kevin, or are we not even in the ball game as far as you're concerned?
We're starting to play. I think that's the message. I think that's the message. Too late. We should have started when this shortfall started, which was about 1980 or so. We started falling behind. So 35 years later, we're starting to play the game.
But it suggests we have a long ways to go to be where we got to be.
Huge message. Very mm-hmm. important message that it took us a long time to get ourselves into this mess. It's going to take us a long time to get ourselves out. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do. We have to do it. But don't expect to turn the corner anytime soon.
Kevin Murphy is my guest. He's an economist. He teaches at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's speaking at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch, not very far from where we sit right now. During your career, Kevin, you have focused on trying to understand why some countries, I'm thinking about South Korea, for instance, develop rapidly, while others with even sometimes comparable technology fail to grow. What have you found out there? It's such an interesting idea to me.
Well, I think part of it is related to what we talked about here, which is getting their population, using the advantages they have in their population. And often that means, in the case of countries like Korea, opening up to the world market and allowing themselves to say, hey, I don't have to do everything for myself. The countries that have really struggled are countries who say, oh, I need to develop all my own industries. I really need to be inward looking. Outward-looking countries have tended to do very well because, think about it, they can do what they're good at and not do what they're bad at.
Mm-hmm. Are we outwardly looking enough in this country?
No. Mm-hmm. We could do much better. I think we have to be diligent to realize that there are a lot of long-run benefits of being outward-looking. There are mm-hmm. going to be some short-run pain. And there's no question there's pain. That is, whenever you open yourself up to trade, economists are famous for saying trade's great. And trade is, and it is great.
Yeah.
The thing is though, trade, while good on average, always has its winners and losers.
Yeah.
And it's very painful for the losers. And it often takes time for them to adjust.
Yeah, we're talking about the skill gap and how that needs to accelerate. We need to train more workers quickly in this country. You know, as one major solution here, another might be a lot of people might look at our tax code and say, hey, we just simply need to tax the rich a whole lot more, and that'll begin to balance out and shrink this income gap across the country. And an economist like you says what to that?
That won't address the fundamental cause. Right, you're sort of treating the symptom rather than the cause. The cause is this imbalance of supply and demand.
All right,
and if anything, that'll make that imbalance worse rather than better.
The tax changes.
Yes.
Why?
Because it will. You know, what we need is a supply response. It's like saying, okay, price of oil's gone way up. We got too little oil, so let's tax the producers of oil. Mm-hmm. You think that's a good policy?
Right.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, right?
Right. Democrats have a hard time buying that. What you're saying.
Well, I think they're suspicious because mm-hmm. it's a little bit like trade.
Mm-hmm.
Policies often have good features, but they often have winners and losers, and that's what's going on there.
I'm really wondering about how economists like yourself figure out what you figure out, because one thing you've looked at is the impact of longer lives on the economy and the amount of money that improved medical research and longer lives is adding to the total wealth in this country. You've concluded it's like $3 trillion a year based on what you're seeing. How do you figure something like that out?
I think we do it the only way economists know, figure out what people are willing to pay. And that is, we measure all these gains by how much people value them. And if you actually look at the way people behave, one message you clearly get is they value health enormously.
And they'll pay for it.
They'll pay for it. They pay for it by buying safer cars. You know, and take another example. When people learned that smoking was hazardous, a lot of people quit.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a major reduction in smoking because people learned it was more hazardous to their health. Look at how people change their diet and other things in response to information. And all those things tell us that people value their health. I like to do a hypothetical. I tell people, look, I'm going to take you back in time, and I'm going to take you back to 1900, and I'm going to give you a choice. You can take today's health and longevity, or you can keep today's material wealth. But whichever one you don't take, you're going to get the one from 100 plus years ago. Mm-hmm. Which one you want to take?
They'll take the health every time.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And that's led you to conclude that a greater investment in medical research would be a very smart way to spend some money.
It is a very smart way to spend money, but it's even smarter if we improve our healthcare delivery system.
Mm-hmm.
Because the major downside to health research today is unaffordable success.
Yeah.
That is treatments that cost too much. And if we can clear that, if we can clear the road of that problem, have a rational delivery system, frees up health research to do all kinds of great things.
Just quickly, Kevin, why does improving the quality of life add so much to the total wealth of this country?
It adds value that doesn't necessarily get counted in our GDP figures.
Okay.
It adds value that people, the real value to people. You ask, what do I care about? Well, I want to see my grandkids. I want to live with my spouse for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you really were cared of just about GDP, you'd want people to die the day they retired. But that's not what we want, right? We do not want that. We want people to enjoy their lives. And one of the biggest things they enjoy is being healthy.
That's Kevin Murphy from the University of Chicago. He'll speak tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library and the Plaza. More information, kclibrary.org. Kevin, thanks so much. Good luck tonight.
Thank you. I
enjoyed
love being
you.
Here.
Look who's here, Brian McTavish, who wants to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend. How are you?
I'm just rocking out.
You're just rocking out to that because...
I am rocking out to the
it's
records.
It's Record Store Day tomorrow.
It is Record Store Day tomorrow.
What
and
is
I
Record
thought,
Store Day?
Well, before we get there, let's all just take a moment That was it. Let's take another moment. There it is again, to enjoy the records being played underneath our voices. That Starry Eyes from the late 70s. I loved the records. They had one hit record.
That's the name of the group, The Records.
Yes, and this was their hit record called Starry Eyes.
One shot.
If you don't have this, go get it. And you can probably find a used copy on vinyl of The Records' Starry Eyes. God bless them. Out there in record store land during Record Store Day, it's the 10th annual celebration of new and used vinyl, including at, maybe 7 or 8 or 9 area record stores, live music, DJs, and other goodies. This is all day Saturday at various area record stores. And where might that be? Well, go to recordstoreday.com and use the locator service. Do you have a favorite record that you just like to physically have?
You know, I went from records to CDs, the digital, like most people.
Yeah.
But I'm amazed that my sons are just totally into vinyl.
In recent years, I've mostly bought old records for their kitschy album covers.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the ones where they have the pinup model from 1955 that has little or probably nothing to do with the jazz music on the inside. Those are great. You frame those, you put them up, you get made fun of by your friends. But you go out to a record store today, which I just did the other day for fun, Josie Records downtown.
Yeah.
They're part of this on Saturday. And I said, well, gee, how much are these records? And most of them, because they want to move them through the door, $5, $10, $15, $20.
Right.
And you can buy yourself a 30 or 40-year-old record. Now, the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album Picture Disc, if you can find it, that might run you a couple $100.
There you go.
So that's what I like about it. The oldies but goodies and the stuff you can resell and have some fun, you know.
So Record Store Day tomorrow, all around town.
All around town. Check it out. Go to recordstoreday.com.
What do we have here?
Fantasy.
Mariah Carey.
Beats Reality.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
No? I'll buy that.
You're not signing off?
I'm there.
Are you? Oh, that's good, because in this crazy social media world where we have 3,000 pretend friends online, I don't know if that's real.
Well, my friends are all real to me. We gather for dinner each night.
Nice try. Oh, you mean like you put the phone down and you know, do the thing? Where, okay, good for you. But most of us are into make-believe these days.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really do that in style at Spectrum Fantastic Art Live. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the downtown Kansas City Convention Center. Basically, what you have is an incredible appreciation of these fantasy artists that are just coalescing right here in Kansas City across all media from all around the country. They're selling their stuff and they're giving live art demonstrations. Guys with names like Brahm and Frank Cho. Now, Frank Cho, my very favorite modern comic book artist, is going to be there. And
that's your world, man.
I'm telling you what.
Next week
we'll get into it. Planet Comic Con.
Comic Con's next week.
Well, that's just a little preview, folks. But anyway, you know, if you can imagine it, if you can draw it, if you can paint it, you can do it. You can create other worlds, other universes. You know, like, who doesn't want over the mantle a picture of a robot and a dinosaur and a half-naked warrior woman, right? I mean, you could go for that as long as the wife's out of town for a week or two. Could I bring mine over and put it up?
No.
No?
Be sure to see Brian's 6 over-the-top things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Let's talk about not just ordinary comedians, but Canadian comedians.
Yes, Canadian comedians. That would be a nice intro into a little act known as Randy and Mr. Leahy. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of Randy and Mr. Leahy?
No, I have not.
Those are two of the hilarious, debauched, shamefully strange characters on a very popular Canadian television series called Trailer Park Boys. Hmm. Okay? And these two crazy guys, their names are Pat Roach and John Dunsworth. They're part of this cast of characters on this show. And these two guys are the people who run this trailer park, right? Okay, and so they're going to be in town this weekend. And it's really a rare opportunity to see these guys live. They are funny. They drink way too much. They drink so much. I mean, you know, alcoholism is sad, right? But pretend alcoholism, not so much.
Okay, we got a clip here, don't
we? Well, we will in a moment. And I just want to share with you, they kind of start the show off. Well, we heard just a little snatch of it, right? That was the introduction music to the show, and it kind of sounds like something you'd associate with Leave It to Beaver. It's very dreamy and nice. But let's hear a little clip right now a little audio clip between Randy and Mr. Leahy, the characters from Trailer Park Boys, and a real quick setup to a very brief clip. Randy is trying to talk Mr. Leahy out of doing something terrible, pitting the residents of the trailer park against one another because things could go very terribly wrong.
Listen, Mr. Leahy, they could kill one another.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, but we can't be involved with murder.
Exactly, Randy.
Mr. Leahy, is this you talking or the liquor?
Randy. I am the liquor.
There you go.
I am the liquor. Another great line from Mr. Leahy is, listen to what the liquor is telling you, Randy. It will tell you what to do. Wrong, totally politically incorrect, and I'd highly recommend this show, 9 o'clock Saturday night at Aftershock in Miriam.
What do we have here?
Okay, well, it's the stripper.
Yep, there you go.
But it's more than just the stripper at the 2017 Missouri Regional...
That wakes people up.
...Burley Picks. It's the Missouri Regional Burley Pick Show. Burlesque, yes. Twirling tassels and goodness knows what else. And variety performers. I mean, we're talking about ventriloquists, sideshow attractions, drag acts, jugglers, singers, clowns, you name it. It's a regional competition. Never happened here before in Kansas City. The winners will go on to Denver in August if they keep winning. 10 o'clock Friday at the Batcave at Rhythm and Booze.
I want to point out Jack DeJohnette, the great drummer, is at the Gem Theater on Saturday night.
Yeah.
One of the all-time great drummers.
Oh,
and the son of John Coltrane. Robbie Coltrane's playing with him 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Gem, 18th and Vine.
Awesome.
And finally today... That's the Partridge theme, isn't it? I recognize that.
Come on, get happy. You know, there were a lot of fun episodes way back in the day on the Partridge Family. One they never made was, hey, what if the Partridge Family went on an obstacle course? They never did that one.
No, they didn't.
Maybe when they redo the series. Anyway, until that happens, it's the Spring Family Timber Challenge. It's an all-ages, well, ages 5 and up, will commit themselves completely to the outdoor obstacle course. Starting times run from 8:30 in the morning till noon. You go to Zip KC in Bonner Springs and take your chances. Final thought, the family that runs obstacle courses together falls down and gets back up together,
Oh,
Steve.
That's a beautiful thought. That's Brian McTavish with your Weekend To-Do List. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on the show, we explore the art of adventure. We'll also speak with participants of the KC Poetry Throwdown. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.